From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Whiplash. It's the word that comes to mind when I imagine what it's like for those navigating life in the hospitality industry right now. Close. Reopen. Close again. In modern times, restaurants have been a key third space, not home and not work. They've been a place we gathered and let others feed and care for us, even for an hour or so, to recharge or celebrate or simply relax alone over a cup of coffee or a martini between the pressures of work or home. Given restraints on socializing, economic pressure, and the fact that many adults have become full-time stay-at-home parents while trying to keep a job, it's extraordinary that the industry is still delivering us hospitality at all, whether that's in a box or on a patio. Today, we focus our attention on the restaurants, the food, the people, and the pleasure and pain of an industry in the throes of change. Talking about it is an emotional roller coaster, so I thought we could start with some good news. Vincent Williams is the owner of Honey's Kettle. Known for its golden fried chicken and honey-coated biscuits, Vincent opened 20 years ago in Compton, following up with the second location in Culver City 5 years later. Now, Honey Drop Kitchen is here, set to deliver his flagship favorites straight to your door. Hi, Vincent.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so happy to be talking to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well under the conditions we're living under, yes.
Yeah, that's good to hear. We spoke 3 years ago about sustainability in the restaurant business, and you talked quite movingly about the struggles. I mean, little did we know what would be coming. Catch us up from then to the first weeks of coronavirus. Did your restaurant close at any point?
You know, going back in my experience in business, one of the first things I learned is that closing your doors is essentially like losing your momentum. And if you ever close your doors, they may not reopen. So no, we didn't close our doors. We went straight through this thing, battling with it. And we said that unless the law enforcement says we have to close our doors, we're open.
And did you always have delivery?
We always were on the platforms. We have like 5 or 6 different platforms that we had always operated under. So, boy, was that a saving grace. Had we needed to ramp up for those tablets at a time like this, it never would have happened. So, you know, I've been dodging bullets all my life, and it seems like I get these premonitions. When the tablets came out, I said, we got to get on that. And lo and behold, did it really help us during this crisis.
Even though the percentage that you have to pay them is quite high.
Yeah, you don't look at that. You look at what you get. You know, it's, they got to get their portion, but, you know, nothing is free. So we accept that.
The restaurant industry is just woven with people who know how to hustle and can maneuver through adversity, whether it's a night on the pass or, as in your Culver City location, a fire that temporarily shutters the business. How did your sales change during the protests here in LA?
You know, it's amazing, the protests. Now, this whole thing we're going through in our society has just been, you know, over the top in terms of experience. Now, look at this. The COVID hits us, 60% of our business lost overnight. I mean, this was like, oh no, here comes another devastating blow. Behind that, we get the social unrest, we get all the problems going on with that. But lo and behold, there was a lot of information out there about Black-owned businesses and about supporting the restaurant industry. And one day I was in the back kind of cooling my heels after a long, hard day, and someone came and brought me a video of a line that was a block and a half long one way and a block long the other. And I just couldn't believe it, that all of a sudden everybody got interested in Honey's Kettle, and we were just amazed and blown over by it.
People showed up for you.
They sure did, man. But like my pastor says, they were, you know, 3 on a mule. It was just amazing to see.
And have those people, for the most part, been one and done, or have you seen a new community discover you and become regulars?
Well, you know, you get this big blow up when something like that happens, and then things start to settle down. But you settle down at a higher base. We are at a much higher base than we've ever seen before. You know, remember, 60% of the business overnight was gone. But because we always were in the model of a 50-50 takeout to eat-in kind of concept, what happened was we essentially lost all the eat-in, but it shifted over to all delivery and takeout. So that number went up 100% while the eat-in people weren't coming in. But then when they allowed them in for a minute, those numbers started to return to where we used to have them before.
Oh, so interesting. So tell us about Honey Drop Kitchen.
Oh, I'm so excited about this. You know, Honey's Kettle in Culver City is like the goose that laid the golden egg. The thing about the Honey Drop Kitchen is it's essentially a kitchen. It's really geared towards like what we're doing today. The delivery, where we can only go so far with delivery here in Culver City, say 5 miles. Now our reach is going to extend to 5 miles around USC, actually more like 7 miles. And then in August, we'll have our second child, and that one will expand our reach in the Hollywood area to Beverly Hills, to the Valley, to Koreatown. So we're extremely excited. And Honey Drop, we don't interface with the customer. It just becomes a food production facility. But eventually we'll allow for pickup. But right now, because we've been in this model already, we deliver to areas all around Los Angeles. And it's my personal responsibility as master chef that when customers tell me, I want you in Moreno Valley, I want you in New York, I want you here, and all I could ever say before was, oh, well, maybe one day, knowing that the one day may not ever come, now we have a vehicle to begin to reach people all over the country.
It's always lovely to talk to you. I'm so glad we were able to check in, Vincent.
Yeah, Evan, you know, you're like, you know, that one you have in your living room or your den. You sit there and just chat it up. I love talking to you.
Maybe after this is all over, we can sit down and have a drink together.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? Or two.
Yeah.
Or maybe three. That would be fun.
Take care.
Okay. Thanks, Evan, for calling.
That is Vincent Williams of Honey's Kettle and now Honey Drop. Coming up, restaurant critics are lining up to say that they're not ready to return to restaurants anytime soon. What does that mean for restaurateurs who are following all the rules and reopening their businesses? We talk to a critic and a restaurateur next. Welcome back to Good Food. A restaurant critic's job is to be like a shark, roving, eating, thinking, writing. When restaurants shut down, where does that leave them? The crucial element of hospitality, which envelops a reviewable dining experience, disappeared overnight. Hospitality became what was communicated in boxes brought to your door or picked up. You'd think that the second restaurants reopened for in-house dining, critics would be the first to make reservations, but many are saying not so fast. We check in with Ryan Sutton, chief critic for Eater New York. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
How are you? I know that you were sick with coronavirus a while back.
I'm good. Thanks for asking. I was one of the earlier cases. I was one of the first people, I like to think, in the grand scheme of things, to get it. Over 136,000 people in the United States have died from COVID-19. I did not die, nor did I come anywhere close to experiencing serious health repercussions, to the best of my knowledge. I got sick, I believe, on March 9th. I got healthy, I like to think, reasonably soon. I had a nasty dry cough for about a month, but the absolute worst effects of it only lasted a few days. I can say without any equivocation, however, it's one of the worst things I ever went through. And I've been through quite a few medical ordeals. I had H1N1 10 years ago. And I'll tell you, swine flu is no walk in the park either. But COVID-19 is pretty bad, even if you get one of the minor cases. And as someone who has had parents who have both had it, and my mother had anosmia, she couldn't smell or taste for the better part of a month, maybe 2 months or longer. I'm quite attuned to the fact that it's not just about living or dying. It's about mental stress, and it's about learning possibly to cope with lifelong medical repercussions. And that's a very big deal for everyone involved, and especially in the food industry.
Talk about the role of restaurant critics and leading by example.
As a restaurant critic, I just don't feel it is morally responsible for me to engage in an activity that I think, through my own actions, could harm other people, whether it be other diners or the often underpaid people who serve us at restaurants. You know, as I write in my column, as I've said before, you know, if a president doesn't wear a mask, his followers don't wear masks. If a restaurant critic eats out on a regular basis, filing dispatches from, you know, all corners of the city or country, I think that would send the wrong message to say that it is almost morally unambiguous that we should be dining out and putting fellow diners and fellow restaurant workers at risk. And you know, the way I see it is that, you know, dining at restaurants is a leisure activity. And yes, it's an economic activity that keeps people employed. But to me, the simple equation of risking deaths or permanent sickness for leisure seems to be a reasonably or incredibly unfair transaction, especially when many of the parties involved, you know, waiters, bartenders, chefs, bussers, don't get hazard pay. Those people could be very well be earning less on the job than on, you know, unemployment. And those people who sign up for the jobs didn't expect serious health repercussions in the first place.
One thing that I've always thought was really interesting is the role of the critic in sitting in for the customer and maybe also coaching the eater on how to be a good customer. And one of the things I think is happening now is many eaters are not necessarily being good customers. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I have many thoughts about that. And again, each state has their own guideline. I think what's interesting in New York City and in New York State, for example, which is where I'm from, is that you do not need to wear your mask the second you sit down at a table, which I think is pretty incredible. I think it goes without saying that we understand that a patron can't sip, you know, a Tom Collins through a mask, or, you know, drink borscht through a mask, or eat pierogies that way. But according to New York guidelines, customers are strongly encouraged to keep their masks on while they're not actively eating or drinking. That's a pretty fair guideline. Do people actually do that? I can tell you that pretty simply. No, they don't. The second they sit at the table, and I, even though I'm not eating out, I witness this, no one has their masks on while they're at the tables, and they don't put them back on until they leave the table or they leave the restaurant. And so again, I think that harkens back to that dichotomy between people engaging in leisure and taking fewer risks while putting the people around them at risk. So if you want to be, I think, a better diner, if you're going to be dining outdoors or indoors, if that's allowed in your jurisdiction or where you live, you should keep your mask on while you're not actively eating or drinking. And that means having, you know, and that very well might mean having a conversation with your parents or your relatives with a mask on at a dinner table, which is, it seems odd, but I think it's the only fair and safe thing to do given the risks that hospitality workers are taking.
A recent Bloomberg survey cites that more people intend to cook at home even after bans are lifted. What do you think that means for the longevity of restaurants?
That's a great question. And I've cited that survey before by Bloomberg. And I think it means restaurants and places that people eat at or drink at need the change. I think one of the things that people in the food world, whether they be, you know, chefs or food writers or critics or reporters, need to realize is that a sit-down restaurant is not the primary point of contact for most people with the larger food world. We may be able to do it in New York, whether because of what we earn or because, you know, restaurants are extensions of our living rooms. You know, we can find a cheap enough place where we can go sit down at every night. But most people don't do that. I like to think that grocery stores and takeout and bodegas and food vendors and street trucks are how so many more people interact with our larger food world. And I think if sit-down restaurants or the chefs who power those places want to remain relevant, it's not going to be about crossing their fingers and hoping for federal support and hoping people come back. It's going to mean a fundamental restructuring of what it means to interact with the food world.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for chatting with me.
Ryan Sutton is the chief critic for Eater New York. We've been discussing the risk-reward of dining out. For restaurateurs, the question of risk-reward is different, and particularly for those who have followed state guidelines and worked tirelessly to reopen. I'm sure it's a gut punch to read a chorus of critics saying not so fast. Carolyn Stein and Suzanne Goen are the powerhouse partners behind the Luke Group of Restaurants. In business together since the 1990s, they've navigated the ups and downs of the U.S. economy and restaurant trends while setting plenty themselves. Carolyn is an award-winning sommelier and wine director whose business acumen allowed the group to expand to 10 locations throughout Los Angeles. Hello, my dear. How are you?
I'm okay. It's a funny question nowadays, but I'm doing all right. I'm healthy.
That's excellent. Your 21-year-old flagship restaurant, Luke, closed right before everything shut down. It seemed so abrupt. Was the closing something you and Suzanne had been planning for some time?
Well, I'll tell you, actually, the closure actually happened when the shutdown happened. We had made the decision in about November to close Luke and had originally planned our last night to be, I think it was May 8th of 2020. You know, the restaurant had been in existence for a long time, and we sort of felt like its time was coming to an end, and we would rather close it while it was still doing fairly strongly than have it wither on the vine. So we actually ended up closing abruptly because of the shutdown. We weren't able to sort of get that, you know, great last farewell few months in because we just weren't able to operate anymore.
That must have been so heartbreaking to not even be able to have a huge party.
Oh, excruciating. I mean, I've cried many tears, but I have to say, amid everything else that's going on, we never got to really mourn it because we had to go into triage mode immediately.
Your hospitality philosophy has always included the well-being of employees. How hard was it to make the decision whether or not to open for outdoor dining?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. The well-being of our employees has been, you know, the source of so much torture and stress and pain. We have so many people who work with us that we love so much, and we're just not able to keep them employed right now. And it's heartbreaking. You know, out of AOC, we opened for to go beginning of May. We decided, okay, let's open back up and just do to go and delivery. And we got a PPP loan. So we said, okay, let's bring our staff back and let's do what we can right now. And so we did takeout and delivery only. And, you know, the staff that was there has been fairly happy. And there's something kind of nice about being around people, even if you're 6 feet away, and having that connection with our work family again. And so when we were given the okay to open up for dine-in, everyone was pretty much on board with it. So anybody who wasn't up for it, who didn't feel comfortable, you know, they decided not to participate. And anybody who was, you know, joined forces with us, and we went for it. And, you know, we've been following the health guidelines to the T. Our tables are spaced far apart. You know, we're wearing all the protective gear. We're using the gloves. We're sanitizing every 30 minutes. We're all over it. And at first it seemed like it was going to be really difficult to do, but we're finding it's now second nature. And there's just something about bringing everybody back together that's been really therapeutic for all of us. You know, the face shields and everything are not the most comfortable things to wear, but we also know that we all feel super safe while we're doing it. So
did opening the AOC patio make an actual difference towards profitability, or is it really marginal?
Yeah, that's been really tough because we're blessed at AOC with some real estate. So we had our patio already, and we had our indoor main dining room, which was very open to the patio. And then we have our wine room upstairs. It's very open to the patio. And so when we were able to have the indoor spaces as well as our patio, we were at about 50% capacity. When the indoor dining was shut down, you know, it took us to probably a third of what our normal capacity would be, or maybe even less, 25%. So we invested in turning our parking lot into an outdoor patio. And it's beautiful, but it was not inexpensive. We built fencing around it. We lit it. We brought in olive tree and plants and furniture to make it as lovely a dining experience as it is on our normal patio. And what that did was it brought us back up to 50% of our capacity. So when we were initially planning our parking lot patio, we thought, oh, this is great. Once we get it in place, we'll be back at 100% capacity. But then we lost our indoor dining. So it took us back to where we began. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily a money-making situation. It's not a long-term viability option. It's just, this is how we're going to hold tight for a while, as long as we can.
I know that you're very involved with the Independent Restaurant Coalition, an organization formed to lobby the government on behalf of independent restaurants. Is extending federal benefits on the table, federal unemployment benefits?
Well, we're lobbying for something called the Restaurants Act, and that was introduced by Congressman Blumenauer from Oregon. And a counterpart to that is actually a Republican Senator Wicker from Mississippi, who's presented a very similar bill in the Senate. And this Restaurants Act would replace lost revenues for the year for independent restaurants to be able to pay their suppliers, pay their rent, bring employees back and put them on payroll, and essentially kickstart not only a restaurant's ability to survive, but also all of those different industries that rely on restaurants. I mean, farmers, wineries, breweries, ranchers, fisheries, importers and distributors, and, you know, accounting firms, and the countless industries that are supported by the restaurant industry. And so this is the big focus of it. And part of the extending of federal unemployment benefits is actually not part of that, because theoretically we would bring back our employees and they would come off of unemployment.
Can you talk about the success of PPP for you, or the difficulty? I know that part of the package that's being proposed in Congress deals with tweaking PPP.
Yeah, there have been many tweaks on PPP from the beginning. I mean, you have to appreciate that Congress is trying to do something to help businesses. It is such a minefield, PPP loan, because really we got these loans to hire back employees that we didn't need to hire back for business that we weren't able to operate. You know, we were fortunate in that we got our loans in the first round, but the double-edged sword of that is that we had to use it up in the first 8 weeks. And we had to use it in a certain way. You had to bring back all of your, you know, full-time equivalent headcount and get them back up to their 2019 wage rates and do it immediately and get them going. And you have to literally had to map out your 8 weeks of spending to make sure you spent the money correctly. It was great to be able to get people paid. And for those people who, you know, would benefit from not being on unemployment, it was great, and get them their health insurance back. I mean, it was a good thing to do for our employees. And we got a couple of months of rent paid, which is great because we had no income. But the problem with it is that when the 24 weeks got extended, it didn't help us we would have spent the money differently if we had had that money to spread out over 24 weeks. And I think a lot of people are in the same boat with us. Financially, we're not any better than we were before we got the loan.
Just to give listeners a perspective into how large the independent restaurant hospitality business is, how many people are employed by independent restaurants?
Yeah. Shockingly, restaurants account for 11 million jobs in the United States. We employ more people than the airline industry. We employ more people than any industry except for, I think, the federal government. There are another 10 million jobs that are supported by restaurants, again, with, you know, from farmers to distributors to every other industry that that feeds the restaurant industry. So the impact financially of the restaurant industry's success is substantial, for sure.
For years, one of the major trajectories for success for Restaurateur was to do what you and Suzanne did, create a group made up of multiple locations. Do you think that makes what's going on now easier or more difficult to navigate?
Oh, you know, that's so funny. I talk about this a lot lately because, you know, you get into this mentality in business. It's like more and more and more. You have to expand, you have to expand, you have to expand. And some part of me right now is feeling like, oh, less is more. You know, it's great to be diversified. I've always thought having different businesses is, you know, a smart way to operate. That's why we've got a catering company. We've got a bread baking business. You know, we have the restaurants. We've got a, you know, more formal and less formal. And I think, you know, just the more things that I find ourselves juggling right now, it's just made it hard across the spectrum. None of these businesses has come away unscathed by this. So for us, it's just juggling more and having to lay off more employees and dealing with so much. And I'm kind of wondering if, you know, we're better off with less to make it easier in life. It's, I don't know, existential question right now.
Yeah, a lot of existential questions right now. Finally, how do you feel when you read critics like Ryan Sutton or Bill Addison who say they aren't going out and they feel that it's irresponsible to do so?
Yeah, so hard because, you know, that's there when they say that it's affecting the livelihoods of my employees and myself and, you know, everybody that we support. I'm so responsible for so many people that, you know, I hate to read that and I hate for people with influence to say that, but I also know that's, you know, hey, it's a free country and everybody is entitled to their opinion. And I know that the way we are operating is incredibly safe and incredibly careful, and we're not risking our employees' safety, and we're not risking our guests' safety. You know, can I say that for everybody else doing this? No, I don't know how they're operating, but I do know that we would not do anything that would jeopardize the health of anybody that comes into our restaurants. You know, we're battling the fear factor too. We're not only are battling the idea that we can't have as many people in the space as we need to be successful, but we know that we're also, you know, a lot of people are afraid, and it's a scary moment. It really is.
Thank you so much, Carolyn.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Give our best to Suzanne.
Oh, I will. Definitely.
That was Carolyn Stein. Together with Chef Suzanne Goen, she helms the Luke Restaurant Group. So, let's say you're a server, a line cook, a sommelier, and your restaurant is reopening. Would you go back? We hear from 8 employees about what it's like navigating the reopening. That's in 1 minute on Good Food. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. We all have our opinions about the reopening of restaurants, but no matter what I think, I'm not the one who would be going back to work, who would be standing on a hotline with a mask on, or taking an order behind a mask and a face shield. Last week, we reached out to hospitality professionals and asked them to share their experience of closing down and going back to work. Some chose to share their names and where they worked, and others did not. Here's what they had to say.
Okay, so hello, my name is Jordan. I'm a bartender in a restaurant in downtown Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I'm a pastry chef in Los Angeles.
I am a server in Los Angeles, and I have been in the service industry for over 10 years.
I'm Aaron Robbins, chef owner of Boneyard Bistro in Sherman Oaks.
My name is Lena Gujan, and my most previous jobs were sommelier at Major Domo and Nomad.
My name is Adrian Juarez. I work at Bevel as a floor manager.
My name is Joe. I am a server at a smaller corporate restaurant in the Old Town Pasadena area.
So my name is Alejandro Guzman. I was the sous chef at Le Comptoir before the pandemic, and I am currently the chef at Babby's LA. I believe it was March 16th when we realized everything was being shut down. Little by little, started to figure out that it wasn't really going to reopen.
We really were just in shock, not sure what was going to happen.
I mean, the day seems like it was yesterday, just having to talk to everybody, especially predominantly Spanish speakers, as I am fluent and of Mexican descent. I kind of had to talk to all of these employees, back of house employees in particular, and kind of explaining a situation that I myself didn't really understand.
We like shut the whole restaurant down that we had just opened up, kind of like hugged each other goodbye, some elbow taps. I think that's when that was starting, and like just left. It was wild.
On the 18th, I received a text message from my boss owner telling me that everything was going to be figured out, that we were going to have some sort of plan. And then on the 26th, I received an email announcing my the dissolution of my position, essentially.
The best I could do was like share whatever information I had, like about if you could go get a test somewhere, like can I get anything for you? Can I bring you bread?
How to apply for unemployment or provide all these resources that they might need moving forward. It was just heartbreaking for a lot of cases in which some people for X reason couldn't qualify for benefits and were jobless after that day.
It was really scary not knowing how we were going to be earning money and wondering if that $450 was going to be enough with the unemployment benefits to sustain just living in such an expensive area in Southern California.
As much as I would love to jump back in the opportunity of working, especially with wine, I love it so much, I just don't feel safe. I feel like even if I wore a mask, even if I wore gloves, I think I would definitely come home worried at the end of the night.
I try to think to myself, what would be worth me going out for a cooking job? You know, like how much would I have to be paid to be able to put my life at risk?
Luckily, our restaurant is quite large. We had plenty of space to spread out. It felt very safe to me.
I was very excited to come back. I've worked in restaurants for over 10 years. You know, it's just like what I do. But once case numbers started to rise again, and it suddenly looked like we were reopening, I was kind of appalled and really taken aback. And my mind and my gut were telling me that, like, this is not something you should be doing right now, if only to just not contribute to the culture of pretending like this virus is gone. So I was invited back and was told that, like, you know, let us know if you're not comfortable with coming back. But I kind of looked at it as if, you know what, like, I felt like if I said that, there was a possibility that my unemployment could be taken away. So I was like, I'm gonna go back, I'm gonna see what's up, and I'll leave if it just feels wrong. And I ended up leaving because it just felt wrong.
The place we're working at, honestly, they've gone above and beyond. I mean, your temperature is checked. And then, when you get on the elevator, it's 4-2-1 elevator in each corner. And then you get up on the another floor, your temperature is checked again. So, you know, we're gloved, masked, and visors. So it's like we're going to war out there.
Everyone's in face shields. Everyone has all this protective gear on and is standing far apart from you. It's hard to hear them.
Instead of taking their order, we're actually giving them paper menus and they fill it out, and then we retrieve that, put their order in, dispose of that paper menu, and then bring their food, bring their drinks, all the same things that we would.
the payment process has become more confusing because it's like, well, who can touch the pen? Who can touch the signed receipt? You know, will it blow away?
As I see it right now, when you see servers covered head to toe in PPE, as a patron, you don't feel right. You know, it's what am I putting them under risk for? That they're having to wear PPE while I'm having a jolly cocktail.
Guests do approach the host stand without a mask, and we ask them to wear a mask, wear the mask that they have, and if not, we have masks that we provide for them. The host relays that message that it's necessary from whenever you're up from the table, and I do the same once I greet the table. But some are not as compliant as others.
You know, you get the people who, you know, they get up from their table to go use the restroom and they forgot their mask, and you just kind of, we have signs everywhere that say mask, and kind of just do a kind of mime to them mask, and they go, oh yeah. But others are like, seriously, I'm going to the restroom, you're making me put on my mask? It's like, dude, it's not our rules.
It's just inconsiderate for everyone.
The customer is always right. I know we always heard that, but to be honest with you, customers very often wrong. I mean, matter of fact, they're really never right. But obviously you can't let them know that. At the end of the day, it's just, all we're asking is put a mask on. Like, just put a mask on. You lose faith in humanity, I guess, after looking at all these people come in there and just have no regard for like what's going on in the world. And I get it, you're home and you want to get out of your house and go out, but
it's hard to have respect for people who are going out right now, unfortunately. And that's like the hardest part, is that you want to be hospitable and serving people, and like you're literally like feeding them, you know, and to be doing that but feel like, I don't know, just confused about who these people are and why they're here, and try to keep your respect for them is really, really tricky.
There are a lot of great customers out there, but you would think that all this time at home, people would have had time to reflect and do some, like, you know, looking in the mirror. But it seems to, you know, people still suck. They're not changing.
If we're doing everything possible, then it's really the guests that need to understand that we're doing what we can to serve them. But if they won't let us do that, then it's their problem, not ours.
I think that what's been really telling in our industry and in others is, there's been a lot of talk about this, but that the unemployment we were getting, for most of us, even for me as a manager, my unemployment checks were more than what I make at the restaurant. And I think instead of being like, this is a special time, like, I think we really need to take that into account and figure out like why restaurants were so unsustainable in the first place, which they were. I mean, this just basically forced a reckoning to happen. Even looking for like my own, like my future, like, do I want to open a shop, you know? And it's like, if I can only pay people $16 an hour, $15 an hour, no, I don't want that. I don't know, it's so tough. Like, yes, prices should go up. People need to understand that like your $16 bowl of pasta, you're not just like paying for noodles, like you're paying the dishwasher, the porter, the line cook, the prep cook who prepared it, you know? There's like so much more. But then at the same time, it's like, if a bowl of pasta costs what it should, which maybe is $32, like me as a cook, I don't get to eat it anymore.
In the short term, I am not optimistic. It is going to be a very rough, bumpy road. There's no way most businesses are going to handle another 90 to 180 days of this.
I feel optimistic about the future of the industry, but I don't believe that it is ever going to be as it once was. Very, very, very few are going to really, really survive, just because the margins are so low, and it's such a labor of love, and it takes so many people to make one ingredient on a multi-ingredient dish, and it's not going to be that way anymore.
My optimism for the hospitality industry is going to be based on if restaurants are willing to make changes for both employees and for guests, and they're willing to make those changes actively. But because we're obviously based off of attendance of guests, that it's really the guests that need to make the most changes, and it's going to be a long time before we're back to where we were.
Thank you to everyone who contributed to that story, and my heartfelt gratitude to those who are on the front lines. I've lived the restaurant industry's dysfunction. But the pandemic has laid bare to the outside world what those of us in the industry have known for years. It's a system built on low wages, poor job mobility, high turnover, and burnout. For an industry that pays a lot of lip service to sustainability of ingredients, it's unsustainable for those who depend on it for their livelihood, oftentimes including the owners. John DeBerry wants to change that. He spent 10 years in the New York hospitality world before he co-founded the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation, an organization that aims to address quality of life issues in the restaurant worker population. What resources are you providing for out-of-work restaurant workers right now?
Quite a bit, actually. In our COVID fund, we've been able to raise so far about $6.5 million between commitments and actual received donations. 50% of that is going to an organization called Southern Smoke, which is doing direct financial assistance to restaurant workers who are facing very severe crises. A quarter of our fund is going to nonprofits that are doing relief work. And then the last quarter is going to establish a zero interest loan program for small businesses that are trying to stay afloat, get back up and running, et cetera. And then we're also trying to aggregate connections and knowledge and resources for people. So from day one, we had a pretty legit resource page for people to go to. And we actually last week just released a manager resource packet specifically for people to check in with their staff and give them connections to resources and some guidance as to what to do. And had a lot of people working really hard on that, translating it into 8 languages. So it's a great resource for people who have teams that they're looking after and ways to check in with them and make sure that they're taken care of and they're getting through this.
It's really an impressive website. I mean, one can spend hours on it, literally, just going through all of the resources that are there. Earlier in today's show, we heard from a number of people in the industry who said that they love the hospitality industry, but they don't want to go back to the way things were before COVID-19, that the restaurants as we know them are broken ecosystems. Your organization has drafted a set of guidelines for the industry moving forward, and I'd love if we could talk about it in some detail. Can you walk us through some of the changes that you're calling for?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of different ways to approach this problem because I think it's sort of easy to point the finger at restaurant owners and say, oh, well, you're bad actors and you need to be called out. And a lot of times that's not really the way it is. It usually has to do with just a lack of knowledge and maybe not quite an understanding of how the law works or how to appropriately structure your business model. But also it requires systemic solutions from outside the industry, like higher minimum wage, reducing the tip credit, which a lot of people don't know about, where the federal minimum wage for tip workers is $2.13. And the difference between that and the official minimum wage is expected to be made up by tips. A lot of leverage is put in the hands of diners, and people don't know that people are subject to a lot of wage theft. So there are things that are legislative solutions that need to be addressed. We need to have some kind of universal form of healthcare, Medicare for all, however you want to call it, because people in the restaurant industry do have such tenuous employment that tying it to their job is just really dangerous. Immigration reform needs to happen. And a lot of it's just about communication with your staff and having the right policies and knowing how to handle issues and just being able to address a mental health problem when it comes up or know how to handle an incident of sexual assault. So these draft guidelines we've created are sort of as we have them now, they are kind of the jumping off point. And one of the things that we wanted to do this year when we could get people in a room together is to have different workshops for each of our different program areas and have actual buy-in from different segments of the industry, like owners, front of house managers, back of house managers, hourly employees, et cetera.
So one of the things that really fascinates me is the aspect of what giving workers increased stability and benefits that they so desperately need will cost more. And menu prices would rise. And during this period of time, I've been fascinated to see how willing eaters are to embrace rather large delivery fees and tips on top of that. Do you think customers are more likely to pay more now, and that perhaps restaurants might be more able to create menus that are all in pricing?
Yeah, I mean, that's stuff. That's something I think about all the time in terms of a no tipping business model, or even with delivery fees and the value of food. I've worked in restaurants for a long time, and a lot of times you'll get people give you feedback. They're like, well, I could go out and buy this and just put it on a plate and it would cost me $10. Why am I paying $50 for this? And it's like, well, you aren't really paying for the food. You're paying for the experience. You're paying for the time. You're paying for the staff's emotional labor. And I think what people are seeing now is how important that was. It was kind of invisible for everybody, sort of this theater where everything seemed effortless and a lot of the work was kept behind the scenes and in the kitchen, dish pit. But now that people are kind of being forced to live without restaurants and cook more of their own meals, I think that they're seeing that restaurants offered so much more than just food on a plate. And I think that there is a willingness for people to actually pay for that. But it's been kind of frustrating to see, you mentioned at the beginning that there's this huge amount of attention paid to the provenance of your food and whether or not there was some sustainable farming practices or, heirloom preservation of genetic diversity in their crops. But then there's literally no thought given to the health of the people who are standing in front of them. So it's a really big cultural shift to try to get to happen. But I think that this pandemic crisis moment and this like sudden revocation of access to restaurants is sort of giving people a chance to step back and see like, well, what am I really paying for here? And is it worth it for me? And I think for a lot of people, they're kind of coming to terms with what they're willing to do to pay to get this experience. For every story of someone tipping $200 on a delivery order, I see pictures of receipts for people who get takeout or delivery and tip nothing.
Which is just inconceivable to me.
Yeah.
It's funny because as you were talking, I was thinking that anyone who's been quarantined for 4 months cooking 3 meals a day would probably say they support higher wages for dishwashers.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I look forward to checking in with you a few months from now. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
That was John DeBerry, founder of the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation. We will have a link to the organization on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. How about some good news? After the break, we learn about a family-run business in Bell Gardens that's breaking the mold. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. The offerings of regional Mexican food in the greater LA area is staggering, even during these weird times. And yet, Afro-Mexican food hasn't been represented, until now, that is. Food journalist Bill Esparza is here to tell us the story behind Tamales Elena. Bill, it has been way too long. How are you?
Yes, it has. I'm great, and it's great to be back and during these strange times.
So strange. So let's jump in. What is Afro-Mexican food? Is there a specific region that we're talking about?
Yes. Afro-Mexican communities have been around for a long time. They were some of the earliest free communities for slaves that were freed and also escaped slaves in Mexico and primarily in Veracruz, La Costa Chica, in Guerrero, and also in that adjoining region in Oaxaca, or kind of cross that the state line between Guerrero and Oaxaca, you have actually Afro-Mexican towns.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. What are some of the names of the towns? Do you know?
Offhand, no. Like where Tamales Elena is from, they don't even call, it's just a bar. It's like a sand bar, and they call it La Barra. And so when I ask her where she's from in La Costa Chica, they're from La Barra. And right there in Watts, lots of the tamaleras, the vendors that have been there since the 90s, are all from La Costa Chica, and they're all Afro-Mexican. And most of them have the same name, Lorenzo, which is like Smith, over there in their community.
So interesting. So when you say you went to Males Elena, in what form was she selling?
Well, they were just selling tamales for the community.
Was she doing this like off a cart, or would she set up a table?
Yeah, a push cart, you know, a shopping cart.
What is her name?
Maria Elena Lorenzo.
So I understand that since your daughters have grown up, they have acquired some hospitality experience.
Yeah, so this is one of the most amazing parts is all of the women in the family are working either front of house, back of house. Judith, who actually was working with John Sedler right about the time, right before Rivera closed, and she had moved up on his hotline, which was really, you know, something, because she was brought there just to do those famous tortillas florales that Chef John Sedler used to do. And so she's the most, I guess, in the chef world, the most accomplished of the sisters. And you should see the place. I went by to look at it, and there's some pictures in my article on Eater LA, and they've really done an amazing job. I mean, it looks like a cute little place, you know?
So what we're talking about is that this woman, with the help of her daughters, has opened or is about to open a brick and mortar.
That's correct.
Just the idea that there is someone engaged with that brick and mortar who made those tortillas floreales is just something for me. That was like one of my all-time favorite foods in LA.
It was an amazing dish.
An amazing dish. So let's talk about what they're going to be offering. What is on the menu? What is specifically regional from La Costa Chica? And maybe what else they're making?
Yes, they're going to continue to do tamales, but they're not going to do the economical tamales that they sell at their truck, which are really for the community. So, about feeding people, but they're going to offer their banana leaf tamales, which I've done special orders for over the years, which are just amazing. The tradition of tamales in that part of Mexico, just like in Oaxaca, is banana leaf. And her flavors have always been there. Her flavors have always been from her hometown, using chile costeño. Everything has chile costeño in Maria Elena's cuisine, because that's the chile that they use most.
And what are the properties of chile costeño that we would be able to recognize as separate from others?
In addition to the color, it also has a little bit more heat, and it's super fruity.
What is the color?
It's red. It's a dried red chile. They use the red one. In Oaxaca, they use the yellow for making mole amarillo. It's a mild spiciness, you know. Her food is a little hotter, but it's not hot. I mean, you know, this conception that Mexican cuisines are spicy. They're not. We condiment, but the regular cooking is with more mild to medium dried chiles. And so this just has a little bit more heat than you're going to find in like the guajillo and other, like the chile colorado, which are more for color and flavor rather than heat. And then mole, she's going to be serving a mole dish that's you can only find in people's homes in the Watts area, which is her mole verde with tamales nejos. And tamales nejos are unfilled tamales that are cooked with ash. So they're kind of dark. That's why they're called nejos. And those are used to eat the mole. And really, until now, you could only, if you went to a family's home, an Afro-Mexican family in South Los Angeles, you could have mole verde con tamales nejos, but now you can get it in their restaurant. And the most exciting thing is that they're finally going to be serving their pozole every day, which is something that I'd have to call them and find out when they were going to make it next before. But Guerrero is known for its pozole. It's the best pozole state, but specifically because of Afro-Mexican cooks that make the pozole verde, the green one, the white one. And they're also going to offer red pozole, and they're making a vegan elo pozole, which is made with fresh corn that's not nixtamalized. So they're making something for vegans, which is very much an aspect of that hospitality experience that the daughters are bringing, reaching out to vegans as well.
they must have been planning this for a really long time, and then the pandemic hits. So obviously they'll be doing just takeout until they're able to do interior dining.
Well, they have a drive-through.
They have a drive-through?
It's the only drive-through pozoleria in the United States, probably, right? it's a cute little spot. You know, it's really designed for the times. It hardly has any seating inside. It's got a little patio area, which they can use right now. And it has a drive-thru. So, yes, you can get drive-thru tamales, pozole, guisados, and Afro-Mexican cuisine. And, you know, that's like made for the times.
And in which neighborhood will we find tamales, Elena?
Bell Gardens. The drive-thru is ready. You can get their food to go. Tamales and pozole are great food items to go. And yes, it's, for people who are not used to this, in Mexican culture, we eat soup, hot soup in hot weather.
We're the only culture, I think, that thinks you have to have ice to cool yourself down.
Right.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's been wonderful having you back, especially to share such a unique eating experience.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me.
That was food journalist Bill Esparza. He first wrote about tamales, Elena, for Eater LA. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Paul Smith, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. If you're going out to eat, or even if you're ordering takeout, remember to tip well and be kind. And to all of you working in the hospitality industry right now, thank you. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.